What are the long-run trends in house prices? Why do they continue to rise, and what effect does this have on inequality? Welcome to a special edition of Vox Talks. My name is Tim Phillips, and today I'm at Imperial College Business School in London at a conference titled Housing, Learning from the Past and Looking to the Future, at which these questions and more will be explored. David Miles of Imperial College is chairing the conference. He's a former member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, so I asked him why an academic conference with a large dollop of economic history seems to have attracted so many people whose job it is to set policy for the future.
I think it's important for policymakers to think about the price of housing for two reasons. Firstly, there's been an enormous increase in the price of houses relative to other goods, but also relative to people's incomes, and that's particularly marked here in London where we are. And trying to understand why that has happened, and crucially trying to work out what's going to happen next, really is a big policy issue. And the papers that have been presented here at Imperial College today really do focus on both looking back at the past, trying to understand where we've come from, but also speculating about where we might be going next.
So what do we know about the long-run history of house prices? Surprisingly, not much. But a new discussion paper, ambitiously called The Rate of Return on Everything, has compiled data on four major asset classes, including housing, in advanced economies over the last 150 years. It found that the average rate of return on housing during this time, about 7%, is as high as the return on equities. I asked Alan Taylor of the University of California, Davis, who presented the paper at this conference, where the authors had dug up their data.
Well, that required a lot of chasing around in many different archives and libraries, data sets that other historians have collected, but also original material from newspapers or records kept by governments. So it was a big detective effort, and all credit there to research assistants we hired who were quite tireless in tracking the material down. And a lot of credit to our co-author, Katerina, whose work on housing prices and on rents was really instrumental.
How long has this taken?
We've been working on this on and off on the most recent paper, the especially the equity prices and the housing prices. That's been sort of the last 2 or 3 years.
No one has compiled this housing price data before. Considering how important it is as a component of household wealth, why not?
I think it's just been very challenging to get a kind of comprehensive view. And maybe it's also been a less interesting or exciting asset from the point of view of the demand side within the profession. So research in finance has focused a lot on equity markets and the stock market. And that's drawn a lot of attention to people who've gone out in previous years and decades to build up those equity price data sets. Whereas I think housing has always been kind of more in the shadows of macro and also finance. I think the catalyst for change, obviously, is the financial crisis, which, you know, a major locus of that was in housing, and that triggered people to try again, go back to square one, and I think that's what inspired us.
Were you surprised by what you found out about the rate of return on housing?
I was, yeah. I mean, I think we had no priors. We didn't really know what to expect. That's one of the exciting things about doing historical archival work and collecting new data, that you really don't know what's going to come out of it. And what we came out with is that the rate of return on housing is surprisingly high to us. It's comparable to equities.
Now, in the paper, you call this a puzzle to researchers and to investors. Why is it such a puzzle?
The other key statistical feature is that the volatility measured by the standard deviation of housing returns is about one half that of equities. So on an annualized basis, equities might be 20% standard deviation, for housing more like 9 or 10. So that means it's generating a high return, but it's a much safer return. It's not subject to large upswings or downswings. And it's already the case that finance theory has difficulty explaining why are investors so averse to holding equities. We know that if we hold a diversified portfolio of equities and we hold it for the long run, there may be some ups and downs, but it's probably the best saving vehicle among that, you know, type of financial asset that we could hope to have. It turns out that, at least according to our data, housing's also a good investment, but it's much safer than equities. If there was a mystery to explain the compensation for risk embedded in the equity market, it's even harder then to explain why is there such a high compensation for lower risk in the housing market.
It's also quite intriguing that you could build a relatively safe and very profitable portfolio using international property.
That comes out from the diversification benefits, and we know this for equities too, that if you hold not just a diversified portfolio of firms within a country, but if you buy a global basket of assets, you get some diversification benefits. Well, there are two ways in which those benefits are amplified when you bring the housing data into the picture. The first is you can hold equities and housing, and they're not perfectly correlated, so automatically there's a diversification benefit even within a country. But then, as you say, if you look across countries, it's actually quite a challenge these days to get diversification from your equity portfolio, because the equity index in Europe is correlated with the UK, it's correlated with the US and Japan. Some of that's due to the connectedness of the global economy, and also the overlapping income streams of multinationals are spread all around the globe. Turns out when you look at property, there's much more of a diversification benefit, so you can mitigate your risk by holding a diversified property portfolio even more.
Now that we know more about the returns on housing as an asset, what does this add to the R-G debate that was inspired by the work of Piketty and others recently?
So that was one other angle that we wanted to explore, just to see if those claims held up. And it's, I think, a useful and valid cross-check, because our approach is completely different from the Piketty approach. There, it's focusing on three countries, and it's looking at how wealth evolves over long periods of time, focused on the balance sheets and trying to sort of back out what the implied rates of return are that get you from starting time to end time. That's very kind of top down. Our approach is bottom up, to start by individual asset classes, bills, bonds, equities and housing, individual, one country at a time, one year at a time, find out all of the returns at that granular level, and then build up weight each return by its relevant portfolio weight, sum over time or compound over time the returns to get the long run rates of return. And yet when we do that, and we do it for many more years and many more countries, we end up at a conclusion that strongly correlates with the Piketty R bigger than G, and possibly even R much bigger than G in our data set. There's a spread of maybe on average 3 or 4 percentage points in the long run.
Thomas Steger of Leipzig University was also thinking about how housing costs may be driving inequality. In 1817, David Ricardo had argued that economic growth would mostly benefit landlords, and because land is unequally distributed, this would lead to rising inequality. The paper that Thomas presented, called The Macroeconomics of Housing and the Dynamics of Wealth Inequality, argues that, 200 years later, what the authors call a toxic mixture of characteristics in the housing market is widening the gap between rich and poor, just as Ricardo had predicted. I began by asking him, what's in this toxic mixture?
Housing is special in many respects. We focus on three characteristics. First, the expenditure share for housing is the largest single expenditure share. It's about 20% in the US. It's much higher for continental Europe economies. Second, the housing expenditure share is high for poor agents and is low for rich agents. So there is an inverse variation across income groups. And thirdly, we observe in the data that real rents are increasing over time. And what is more important, we can expect that real rents will increase in the future.
So the toxicity in this is its effect on inequality.
Given that real rents go up continuously, and given that the poor devote a high share of their expenditures on housing, that suppresses their capability to form wealth, and that leads them to stay increasingly behind.
Now, you created a model of this. Your paper's theoretical. Can you explain how the model's created?
We capture the two fundamental sources for an increase in house prices and real rents, which is land scarcity and differential technical change to the disadvantage of the construction sector. And that then implies that as the economy grows, house prices go up and rents go up as well. Second, the model allows for non-homothetical preferences such that expenditure shares, in fact, differ across income groups, which is empirically what we see in the data.
And What are you finding from that model? What's the long-run effect on inequality?
Well, the basic story is actually very simple. As the economy grows, real rents go up. And given that the poor devote a high share of expenditures to housing, that suppresses their saving rates. This reduces their capability to form wealth. What the increase in real rents triggers is a heterogeneity in saving rates to the disadvantage of the poor, such that they stay behind.
This sounds like quite a negative conclusion. Is there something that policymakers can do based on your research?
Well, first of all, I would describe this as a natural implication of this economic structure. If we don't like that as a society, can we do something about it? We should better understand the costs of regulations, zoning regulations, and building restrictions, because these regulations targeting the extensive margin of the housing stock and the intensive margin of the housing stock, they of course have an impact on land scarcity, which has an impact on the dynamics of wealth inequality.
How can policymakers understand what's driving the long-run changes in house prices? In Houses Across Time and Across Place, David Miles and James Sefton of Imperial College Business School have attempted to answer some of these questions by modelling long-run trends in house prices. House prices have behaved very differently in different eras, David explained to me.
The facts on house prices across many developed economies are really rather striking. Overall, the picture looks a bit like this. Between about the middle, or perhaps the second half of the 19th century, 1870 or so, and about 1960, so for about 100 years, although prices moved up and down a lot from year to year, overall the prices of housing didn't move in ways that were different to the prices of other goods. But starting in about 1960, 1970, across many developed economies, and particularly in the UK, there starts to be an enormous increase in the price of houses relative to other things. What was different about that period than the 100 years that had come before? And crucially, what does the next 50 years look like? Does it look like 1870 to 1960, or does it look like 1960 to today? And that'll make a huge difference to the affordability of houses, to our children and grandchildren.
There has been a lot of research into house prices, so what's different about what you're doing?
I think a lot of research on house prices has tended to focus on swings up and down over the short term, what you might call cyclical fluctuations from one year to the next, or maybe one decade to the next. The research that I've been doing, and some of the other papers presented here at Imperial today, are really looking at long-run trends, not trying to understand fluctuations from one year or even one decade to the next, but what about the drivers of the trends over many decades?
And what did you find out?
Crucial factor is the availability of land. And in some sense, of course, land is fixed. The borders of the UK haven't changed very much in centuries, and so the total land area is unchanging. Of course, what does change is the feasibility of building on that land. And one factor we focus on and find is central to understanding trends in prices is how improvements in travel and travel speed basically allow people to live further and further from where they may work and makes it more feasible to build on a larger proportion of the UK, given that we are a country where employment is very much concentrated at the centre of a relatively small number of very big cities. And we find that improvements in transport and transport speed were extremely rapid in the late 19th century and continued to be significant up until maybe the 50s and 60s. And that essentially allowed a country with fixed borders and a fixed amount of land to have a rising amount of land where it was feasible for people to build houses and live. But that stopped maybe 30, 40 years ago, 1970s, 1980s, when there really doesn't seem to have been much improvement in travel infrastructure and travel speeds. And that slows down the expansion and the feasible amount of land to build on in the UK. And we find that that is a very important factor in explaining the very different experience of the last 50 years and the 100 years that came before that in terms of house prices.
Turning that model round, does that mean that house prices will carry on rising forever?
Well, we address that issue and find there's a few factors which are significant. One is travel and travel infrastructure, transport infrastructure. But there are other factors that are very significant as well. One important factor, which I think has been under-researched, is can you vary substantially the ratio between how much the footprint of a house, the land that it uses, and how much structure you erect on that land, so that as land becomes more expensive, you can substitute away from using land and use more structure. Maybe you build higher, maybe you build underground. And if people are prepared to do that, then you get round the problem of having an absolute fixed amount of land, and that will put some cap on how high house prices will go. Final factor, to what extent will people, if house prices continue rising, decide that they're going to use their money and spend it more on cars, restaurants, clothes, foreign travel, staying in nice hotels, and less on housing because housing has got really expensive? The more people are willing and able to substitute away from housing, the less will house prices rise. And we find those two factors are absolutely central to what might happen over the next 50 years.
Finally, David, you've found, I think, in a model that the paths of house prices in the future are quite sensitive to small changes there. This is a challenge for policymakers, isn't it, to observe those small changes in preference?
If the degree of substitutability between, say, using land and using structure is either a bit higher or a bit lower than one's central guess, it actually, we find, makes an enormous difference to how high house prices will go in the future. And that's really sensitive, and it's pretty difficult to be confident about how that substitutability actually might evolve.
Even if these three papers do help us understand what forces are driving house prices, David's conclusion is that designing policy to manage the impact of those price changes won't be easy. But as Jagjit Chadha, director of the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, explains, when the policymakers return to their desks, finding an answer to this problem has never been more important.
A lot of people have talked about how wealthy the household sector is in aggregate. Not everyone is the same. The wealth that exists is distributed quite unequally across the population. That means that shocks that come along to income or shocks that may happen in the economy, such as a change in oil prices, may lead to much larger cyclical or business cycle fluctuations. Reasonably sensible policy is some stability in the housing sector. That allows people to plan, allows people to have a sense of what level of wealth they've got as they retire, and some planning that they can hand over to their children or other descendants over time.
I have been talking to the authors of the three papers presented at the conference Housing, Learning from the Past and Looking to the Future, organised by the CEPR and the Brevan Howard Centre for Financial Analysis at Imperial College Business School. The three papers were The Rate of Return on Everything, presented by Alan Taylor, and there's also a VoxEU column written by the authors which explains this research in more detail, The Macroeconomics of Housing and the Dynamics of Wealth Inequality, presented by Thomas Steger, and Houses Across Time and Across Place, which was presented by David Miles. This has been a Vox Talk, presented by the Centre for Economic Policy Research. For more on a series, visit voxeu.org/vox-talks.